Thou shalt not steal. This will be the Eighth Commandment, Part 14, and I anticipate probably just one more message and we'll complete this series. And if you think, by the way, this has been a long series, just think back to the Seventh Commandment. Because if I'm not mistaken, it was about 28 parts long, so almost twice as long as the Seventh Commandment has been so far. Anyway, in the previous two messages, I've been addressing legalized plunder at the hands of today's U.S. government. As Frederick Bastiat put it in 1848 in France in his treatise, The Law, he said it this way, sometimes the law defends plunder and participates in it. Surprise, surprise. Sometimes? How about all the time? And in multifarious ways when it comes to modern America's case. In fact, it's the proclivity of all governments to do so. That is, at least when they are governments established by man, when they're human governments. Isn't that what Samuel, if you go back to, I think it was in the last message or the message before, and we went back and we read the part of the account where Samuel was telling the people who had clamored for a king. And isn't that some of what he told them? Exactly what was going to happen. It's the proclivity of governments to do so. Now, it may not begin that way with certain governments, but listen to me, all man-made human governments will get there. They may not start that way, but they'll get there. And there isn't a better test case or case example demonstrating this than American government over the last 2,100 years. Look at how it began here in America. Go back to the early 1700s and look how it began with the noble ideas and aspirations that they had, and look what it has become today. There is not a better example, because there was probably not a better man-made government than the one we had here with its in its beginnings. But look what it has become today. And so there's probably not a better case example than what we have right here in America. The reason that all man-made, at least one of the reason that all man-made or human governments eventually legalize and even participate in plunder, among other things, is because no matter how good it is, man's best is still imperfect, and that which is imperfect by its very nature can never attain perfection. It's impossible, and therefore it can only progress in one direction, toward greater imperfection. It starts off imperfect, and it can only get more imperfect, or you might say it can only progress toward greater lawlessness, because that's what imperfection is. Consider what Thomas Jefferson had to say about government and taxes. Quote, fairly famous quotation, so you've probably heard some of it or part of it or maybe all of it before. He said, quote, if we run into such debts that we must be taxed in our meat and in our drink, in our necessaries and our comforts, in our labors and our amusements, for our calling and our creeds, as the people of England are, and we could say as the people of the United States of America are today, he said, our people like them must come to labor 16 hours in 24 and give the earnings of 15 of these to the government for their debts and daily expenses. And the 16th being insufficient to afford us bread, and we're not quite there yet, but for some it is, we must live as they do now on oatmeal and potatoes. Potatoes have no time, and here, listen to this, have no time to think, no means of calling the mismanagers to account. I wonder if some wouldn't like it that way. But to be glad to obtain subsistence by hiring ourselves to rivet their chains around the necks of our fellow sufferers. And this is the tendency of all human governments. He even recognized it was human government and not inspired, as some of our modern patriots want to call it today. Continuing on, he said, a departure from principle in one instance becomes a precedent for a second, that second for a third, and so on till the bulk of the society is reduced to be mere automatons of misery, to have no sensibilities left but for sinning and suffering. And later he said, and the forehorse of this frightful team is public debt. Taxation follows that, and its train, wretchedness and oppression. End of quote. And that is, as Jefferson himself said, that is the destiny of all human governments. Why not instead just begin, or in our case, return to perfection? We can't begin. We've already blew that. But so let's, why not, if you're going to begin one, or in our case, why not just return to perfection? Yahweh's laws and His kingdom. Amen? Sounds like a good idea. Now, back to legalized plunder. How is legal plunder to be identified? Bastier queried. And here's his answer. Quote, quite simply, see if the law takes from some persons what belongs to them and gives to other persons to whom it does not belong. See if the law benefits one citizen at the expense of another by doing what the citizen himself cannot do without committing a crime. End of that quote of Bastier. And then he added this. He said, quote, if such a law, which may be an isolated case, maybe in France. Well, he continues on where it ends up. And he said, quote, if such a law, which may be an isolated case, is not abolished immediately, it will spread, multiply, and develop into a system. End of quote. Like here in the United States of America, and as it has in every other case, in every other human government ever created in man, in the annals of the histories of man. Now, that first statement of Bastier's, which was the law takes from some persons what belongs to them and gives it to other persons to whom it does not belong. What does that sound like in modern jargon? What do we call it today? Welfare. Welfare, which is, if you think about it, not thinking about it as we would normally think of it, but this crowd would normally think of it, but welfare is a nice sounding kind of word, a noble, a nice idea, right? Well, that's what they want us to believe. But instead, it's just another word that has evolved into something disguised as something else. Let's call it socialism. Better yet, let's call it communism. And better yet, even better yet, let's call it what it really is. Plunder, stealing, and theft. That's what it is. I mean, even communism is somewhat of a disguise, and socialism is somewhat of a disguise, and certainly welfare is a disguise for simply plunder and theft. In Bastier's day, they called it fraternity, which is another nice-sounding word for brotherhood. The brotherhood of mankind, or the liberals' utopia, the equality of all mankind, which is an unattainable myth. It is absolutely impossible. Man is not created equal, if you haven't noticed. I've got hair. Hirsch doesn't. And there's a whole lot of other things that aren't equal. All men are not created equal. And neither can man or any group of man attain equality. It was never God's intention and never in His plan. And therefore, government that strives for the equality of man attempts what is absolutely impossible. And I'm not so sure they don't know it. Now, the idea, the goal of fraternity or brotherhood or philanthropy or welfare or whatever else you might want to call it, are grand objectives. They're biblical objectives, are they not? Sure they are. That is, when they are voluntarily, when what you do with what is yours remains in your power under your control, then indeed it's a grand idea. Bastiat put it this way. He says, it's impossible for me to separate the word fraternity, or if you want to put welfare in there, it'll work. He said, it's impossible for me to separate the word fraternity from the word voluntary. You think about it. Fraternity, brotherhood, welfare, charity. It's impossible to separate any of those terms with voluntary. He said, I cannot possibly understand how fraternity can be legally enforced without liberty being legally destroyed, and thus justice being legally trampled underfoot. Legal plunder, he said, has two roots. Excuse me. One of them, as I have said before, is in human greed. And the other is in false philanthropy. End of that quote. To put it simply, liberty is destroyed when fraternity or philanthropy or welfare is in the hands of the government. Liberty is destroyed. Now, charity, let's look at the word charity. Charity, that's what welfare is supposed to portray to us, depict for us. Charity, in order to be true charity, now let's stop right there and think about it. What is charity? Well, from one perspective, charity is the King James Version's term for love. Is it not? 1 Corinthians 13. King James Version. If I have not love, I am nothing. And charity suffereth long, and charity is this, and charity is that, and it's talking about love. Well, listen to me. No one can force someone else to love someone. It has to be voluntary. And so it is with charity today as we normally think of the word. Charity cannot be charity unless it's voluntary. The Bible certainly points that out in 2 Corinthians 9:7. It says, every man according as he, and there's two or three indicators here. It says, every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give. Not grudgingly. Any of you are grudging because of the government taking what's yours and giving it to all these different welfare programs? Doesn't sound like it's what God had in mind. He said, not grudgingly, or, and I'm reading King James, or of necessity, New American Standard is better, under compulsion. Any of you under compulsion, the way the government does it? For God, he says, don't do it that way. He says, for God loveth a cheerful giver. Now, some people would think, well, that's just certainly New Covenant. You know, under the Old Covenant, it was different. They were compulsed, just like they are today. You want to go back to the old law, do you? Well, then there's going to be compulsion when it comes to charity. There are several verses I could have shared with you, but consider Leviticus 19:5. There's nothing has changed, Old or New Covenant, except for the covenant itself had to be kept under compulsion. But as far as giving, God never intended giving to be under compulsion. Here he says, if you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings unto Yahweh, you shall offer it of your own free will. There was no compulsion in it. God didn't want it to be compulsions. In fact, in Isaiah, he condemns them because it had just come down to compulsion. And he says, you do it. You offer and you observe the Sabbath and the other feast days and so forth. He says, but you don't, because it's not from your heart. God wanted it from their heart, even under the old covenant as well. Charity, in order to truly be charity, demands free will. And therefore, for the government to provide handouts on yours or my behalf is simply, what is it? It's organized theft. Organized crime. What do you think of when you think of organized crime? Well, what else? There's something, there's other we call organized, it's organized crime. Down in Chicago? Yeah. The mafia. The government has become a mob. An organized mob with incredible power that the mob down in the mafia down, the mob or the mafia down in Chicago could only dream about having. They don't even begin to get anywhere close. And that exercises its strong arm or its muscle. And somebody may say, "Now wait a minute, what do you mean? I don't see the government doing that." Well, that's because you've been blinded. You know, and I'm not talking about you all here, but there's a lot of people who just can't see that the government, this benevolent good government, has become a mob, exercising its strong arms. What do you mean? How does it do that? Well, do you part with your money the government gives to others voluntarily? And probably most people would say, yes, I do. But let me finish the question. Do you do it voluntarily, or were you coerced and threatened with fines, property confiscation, or even imprisonment? You think if the government hadn't already put that all behind it, that if they said there's no fines, no possibility of losing property, no possibility of imprisonment, that the majority of the people would voluntarily say, yeah, take what's mine and give it to somebody else? They do it now because it's the system. It's the mob. You know, the guys down in Chicago, it's a system. We don't got any other choice. We pay. We do it voluntarily. Not when you go back to its beginnings. If it's the latter, that is, by coercion and threat, if it's the latter, then the government has simply, again, become a mob that exercises its muscle and takes from you your property and your wealth and your posterity's inheritance, or at least part of it. They leave enough for you to stay happy, just like they did in Egypt with the Israelites of old. Let's keep them happy. We'll feed them just enough to keep them here. So much so, I don't think, by the way, that the Egyptian bondage was all that much different than ours. I mean, because if it was as bad as sometimes I think it's portrayed, you know, I think the beatings and that kind of thing were the exception. Just enough to make everybody keep in line. Follow orders. Because the first time they met opposition out in the desert, they wanted to go back. I don't think it was that different from what we have today. Now, where was I? If it's the latter, if the government, again, has simply become a mob, taking from you what simply, taking from you and your posterity what should belong to you, and is simply giving it to someone of their choosing, to someone to whom it doesn't belong at all. It's essentially the same thing again that King Ahab did when he confiscated Naboth's vineyard. To which someone, I was thinking about that, and I thought, you know, someone might object to that, to my comparison, by pointing out that Ahab stole for himself and his own personal enrichment. And to say that isn't a fair comparison. He was doing it for his own sake. And that, of course, is true. But theft is theft, right? Whether you're stealing for yourself or for someone else, it doesn't make any difference. It's still theft. But don't think for a moment that today's government isn't also stealing for itself. People miss this. A 1987 edition of The Witness, and I didn't have the actual volume and number on this, on my the part I'd clipped out of this some years ago, back in 1987. But at least an edition of the Witness contained an article entitled "Social Monster." Let me read this to you: "Social Monster. We've created a welfare monster that is a shocking indictment of our sense of priorities." Now, by the way, that wasn't The Witness, Curtis Dickinson, saying that. He's quoting, he says, "So said President Reagan in 1987 State of the Union address." He continues, not Reagan, but Dickinson, he says, "Since 1950, the number of persons receiving public assistance and social welfare payments has increased." Now listen to this. "From 1950, it has increased from 6 million to more than 30 million. Parentheses, in 1984, latest total overall figures available." People, that was 20 years ago. What do you think it is today? In fact, for the sake of those here in the tape ministry, if you've got those figures, I didn't have time to look them up for this message, but I'd like to have them for the time when this series eventually goes to a book. So if you've got them, please send them to me. Then he continues. He says, in 1985, federal payments to individuals totaled, in 1985, $427.3 billion, while the total to be spent by all government agencies on welfare for the fiscal year 1987 is estimated at $642 billion. And so from 1985 to 1987, it jumped over $220 billion for welfare. What in the world might it be today, 20 years later? All of it, by the way, stolen from others, whether it be $400 billion, $600 billion, or who knows how much today. It's been estimated that 2/3 of the federal budget represents money taken from one American to give to another. 2/3, and you start thinking about all that's involved in this whole scheme of what we might put under the umbrella of welfare, and I'll guarantee you it's a whole lot more than 2/3. But we'll go with that figure. Continuing. And note this, and this is my note, this is my point in particular for going to this particular little article. Note in particular, it says, poverty is big business. About 530,000 government employees are paid to staff the welfare machine. The monthly payroll, 1987, is $600.2 billion a year. This doesn't include the cost of offices, equipment, telephones, and travel expenses, or the vendors who profit at the welfare spigot. Economists figure that it costs about $3 to deliver $1 in public assistance to the poor, which means that only 25 cents out of each dollar is spent on welfare gets to the poor. The other 75 cents stays in the pipeline to fuel the bureaucracy. End of quote. Yeah, but at least 25 cents of every dollar gets to the poor and are therefore improving their position and their quality of life, someone will argue. Oh, yeah? Well, how many poor people do you know that have gotten out of poverty via the U.S. welfare system? How about zilch? Milton Friedman put it this way. He said, if you pay people to be poor, they will be poor. You know, I think that Yahweh had a better idea than that. You pay people to be poor, they'll be poor. Yahweh had a better idea. The April 1985 Reader's Digest ran an editorial review entitled, How Uncle Sam Robbed the... You'd think it said rich, right? This article says, How Uncle Sam Robbed the Poor. Here's the opening paragraph. It reads as follows. Quote, a comprehensive, compelling new study of the working age poor shows that the welfare reforms of the 1960s did not work. There are no victors, only victims in America's war on poverty. End of that quote. But wait a minute. There are some good causes that the government subsidizes with our money. Yeah, some people may think so. But do not miss the operative phrase in that statement. With our money. And therefore, it is theft, plain and simple, without my okay, without coercion or threat. It is theft, plain and simple, whether it's for Social Security, Medicaid, other socialized medical programs, workman's compensation, public education, college loans, grants, domestic or foreign aid, housing for the poor, farm subsidies, bailouts, a war chest for wars of aggression. How much more did they just say they wanted this week? And the list goes on and on and on and on. And they will find more ingenious and more sophisticated ways to do the same as time continues to go on. That's just off the top of my head. It's theft. Because the cause Everybody wants to be, look at the cause. But it's theft, no matter whether the cause, no matter how good sounding it is, or literally even may be. Because the cause can never justify what is unlawful, or in this case, what is plain and simple theft. The cause can never justify that. It would be theft for me if I was to confiscate Bob's car and then sell it and tell him, it's for a good reason, Bob. I'm going to give it the proceeds to the Red Cross. And Bob's going to say, no, you're not. Not if I have anything to do with it. But if I got the muscle, I just take the car. And Bob, you don't understand. It's for a good cause. Well, if it would be theft for me to do it, then it is also theft for a collective force to do essentially the same thing through coercion or threat. Theft is theft, people. Plunder is plunder. Stealing is stealing, no matter at whose hands it's achieved. Today's bureaucrats could learn a lesson from King David. Turn with me, if you will, to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel, the last chapter, chapter 24. And beginning with verse 10. Now this chapter is in Samuel's account, 2 Samuel's account, of the time when David took the unlawful census. One of them being is that he may not have taken the ransom money. Keep in mind, if you read the first verse of this chapter, that God was behind it because he wanted to judge the people. One of the things the people didn't do, a lot of people would say, well, wait a minute, why did God judge the people when it was David who called for the unlawful census? Sometimes God uses the kings to do certain things to judge the people for their misdeeds. One of the things they didn't do was to call David account for doing it. They just let it go by. Keep that in mind. We let a lot go by with this government. Nobody wants to complain. Nobody wants to make noise. And God says, you don't make noise about it. You don't try to make a difference. You don't try to change things. And it may be very well that I will use those kings to bring judgment upon you. Because ultimately, it's the people's responsibility on who leads them and who doesn't. Especially when you understand appointment rather than election. But anyway, that's the setting of what we're talking about here. And in verse 10, after God's now telling David that he's going to judge him. Starting with verse 10, it says, and David's heart smote him after that he had numbered the people. And David said unto Yahweh, I have sinned greatly in that I have done. And now I beseech thee, O Yahweh, take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have done very foolishly. And then the next several verses was the choice of the three things that God gave him. And God then follows through with the choice. And then picking up with verse 17, we find the following. And it says, and David spake unto Yahweh when he saw the angel that smote the people and said, lo, I have sinned and I have done wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? Let thy hand, I pray thee, be against me and against my father's house. And David finally said, Lord, stop dealing with the sheep. It's me. Of course, it was the sheep too. But God heard his prayer, and it says, and God came that day to David and said unto him, go up, rear an altar unto Yahweh in the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. Notice this was by God's command. And David, according to the saying of Gad, went up as Yahweh commanded. And Araunah looked and saw the king and his servants coming on toward him. And Araunah went out and bowed himself before the king on his face upon the ground. And Araunah said, wherefore is my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor of thee, to build an altar unto Yahweh, that the plague may be stayed from the people. All right, picking it up with verse 22. And Araunah said unto David, let my lord the king take and offer up what seemeth good unto him. Behold, here be oxen for burnt offering and threshing instruments and other instruments of the oxen for wood. And Araunah saying, hey, David, don't worry about payment. You just take it. I'll give it to you. Verse 23, all these things did Araunah as a king give him unto the king. And Araunah said unto the king, Yahweh thy God accept thee. And the king said unto Araunah, nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price. Neither will I offer burnt offerings unto Yahweh my God of that which does cost me nothing. So David bought. Now keep that in mind. You know, you say, well, what does this have to do with today? Well, You know, we have all these bureaucrats who have these grandiose ideas of welfare and goodness of heart, who have this, you know, they got these great ideas to come to the aid of the people with that which costs them nothing. And it goes on, so David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver, and David built there an altar unto Yahweh and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So Yahweh was entreated for the land, and the plague was stayed from Israel. Now, although the altar, you think about it, although the altar was for the public's good and welfare, was it not? I mean, they were being slaughtered by God. This was to stay the plague. And even though it was for their good and their welfare, David didn't seize it. You know, hey, this is land. This is, you know, eminent domain gives me the right just to seize the land and take it. Because it's for the public welfare. Isn't that what they tell us? He didn't seize it. He neither seized it. He neither accepted it as a gift, nor did he tax the people, unlike our today's quote-unquote do-gooders, do-gooder bureaucrats do today. He didn't do any of those things. He paid for it himself, as everyone should who wants to participate in some kind of charity. If it looks like somebody has a need, then, and you're moved by the Holy Spirit or whatever other means to you're moved by the situation, don't go steal it from somebody else. Don't go steal Bob's car and sell it. You know, it's theft. That's what it ends up being, is just theft. Robert Ingram, in his book, The World Under God's Law, put it thusly, quote, "The income tax, which seizes property under pain of the most severe punishment, virtually abolishes any man's control over what is his own and substitutes full government regulation over all life for just punishment of crime. The state, which is supposed to punish thieves, becomes itself a monster thief. It plunders men's property as Robin Hood did in order to distribute according to the ideas of man who happens to be running the show at the moment." You know, let's think about government in those terms. It's just a bunch of men who have elevated themselves to say, we know best where all this should go. He goes on, "The law which exists to limit stealing becomes the instrument by which ruthless men seize all property, from the greatest factory to the widow's loaf of bread. A man's house is transformed from his castle to his burden, which may be taken from him by any wild dreamer who produces a plan for what he calls civic betterment." Eminent domain. "The poor, who might get a toehold in the opportunities of the city by living in cheap tenements are denied the chance by slum clearance programs. The rich must hire a battery of experts to advise them as to how to keep out of jail in the management of their affairs or their property. A man is accountable to the government for how he uses whatever he thinks he owns, but at any moment the government may rob him of it. All of this done in the name of justice." You talk about an evolution of a word disguising itself as something else. It's justice. This is justice, the equality of man. An impossible dream. "All of this done in the name of justice. It is Robin Hood's justice in which the rich are robbed and the poor share in the loot. And in so doing, never become poor," I'll add. The end of his quote before that. And I don't know if you've ever given it any thought or not, but it's worse when the government steals from you than when it's at the hands of just a common thief. You ever thought about that? Here's what Walter Williams once said about it. He said, "When a politician robs you, you have to be bored by listening to the reasons why. But a common thief spares you the grief by just taking your possessions and going about his business." End of quote. Now, knowing the benevolent spirit of our people, I don't know about everybody else's benevolent spirit, but knowing the benevolent spirit of our people, which was one of the things that identifies us for who we are, because it was Abraham's descendants who were the people who were to be benevolent and bless the rest of the world. And therefore, knowing the benevolent spirit of our people, I just bet that if 2/3 of the federal government's budget was put back into the hands of those from whom they steal it. If it were then used under biblical guidelines, such as no worky, no eaty, and others, that three things would occur. If you take the two-thirds, and a whole lot more, really, and the interest, don't forget the interest that's goes with that, and put that all back into the hands of the people from whom they steal it with, three things would occur. Number one, that the real needs of others, not all, everything that the government wants to say is a need, but the real needs of others would be better satisfied by the free will generosity of our people. You know, they have proven that time and time again, even above and beyond what the government is already stealing from them. They still do it. Number two, that the money in the hands of private individuals would be used much more efficiently than when funneled through the government bureaucracy. What do you think? I think it just might be. And it would thus go much, much further as well than accomplish much more. In fact, $2 out of $3 would be able to be used for real, genuine needs instead of only $1. Oh, no, excuse me, 25 cents. One out of every $4 or 25 cents out of every dollar. It would all be available because they wouldn't have all the overhead the government somehow comes up with. And then third, that by getting rid of two-thirds or more of the federal budget, and again the interest that accompanies it, would go a long way toward balancing the federal budget that everybody's trying to get done. What do you think? At least those three things would probably come of it. By the way, don't think that the U.S. government has the market cornered on institutionalized theft. Other governments, other nations' governments can be just as ingenious, just as sophisticated, just as slick when it comes to stealing every dime they can get from the people. Take the United Kingdom, for example, just here recently. This comes from the Glasgow Sunday Herald under the heading, "The Cradle of Common Law." Here's what it says. Quote, when suspects are convicted of a crime, and after years in prison, now catch this, are proven to be innocent, how does society repay them for their incarceration? The UK's Home Secretary, David Blunkett, has an idea of what to do. Charge the former prisoners for room and board. At least £3,000, US $5,430 per year, for the prisoners. Saved living expenses during their time in STIR. I guess STIR is the term for imprisonment, or one of them over there. A spokesman of the Home Office said the concept, quote, takes into account the range of costs the prisoners might have incurred had they not been imprisoned, end of quote. Adding, quote, morally, this is a reasonable and appropriate, end of quote within a quote. And guess what? It's not a proposal. The government has already sent bills to some freed prisoners. A spokesman for the Scottish Miscarriage of Justice organization called the program a way to, quote within a quote, punish people for having the audacity of being innocent. Quote, end of quote within a quote. End of quote, Glasgow Sunday Herald I just received. I don't have a date on that, but I suspect it's something that's just recently been taking place. So don't think we have the corner market on how to get every dime you possibly can out of the people. Now, before leaving government theft behind, and wouldn't that be grand to leave it behind? And it can be done, by the way. It can be done that we leave it behind. We just need to get our people, Christians in particular, turned on to Yahweh's laws of liberty and His kingdom. I mean, you talk about a missionary field today. Just the churches alone are a missionary field. We don't need to be sending people over to this country and that country. I mean, we've got a missionary field beyond the churches today, here in America. Plenty of work to do. By the way, missionary work to other nations doesn't work normally work anyway. They've got to come to us and want to know before it's going to work. But we've got a plenty of work right here, right in the churches on this one issue alone. We can leave it behind. If we'd only turn the army we already have in modern quote-unquote Christendom today onto the fact of Yahweh's perfect laws of liberty and His kingdom. But, because we're not there yet, we need to address America's courts in relation to the Eighth Commandment before concluding this series, because it is certainly true that, the courts themselves today are helping to legislate and are stealing from the people as well. Let's begin by going to Exodus 23 and verse 6. How much time do I have remaining there? All right, Exodus 23 and verse 6. We find the following. It says, "Thou shalt not wrest the judgment of thy poor in his cause." Moffat simply, I like it. I like how Moffat puts it. It simply says, never tamper with a poor man's rights in court. And that's the idea. And of course, it was especially in reference to the judges of that day. In Isaiah 10, verses 1 and 2, we find the following. It says, "Woe unto them that decree unrighteous decrees, and that right grievousness which they have prescribed, to turn aside the needy from judgment or justice, and to take away the right from the poor of my people, that widows may be their prey, and that they may rob the fatherless." You think it might happen? Think it happened then? Obviously it did. You think it might happen today? Well, tragically, though that tragically that is a fairly accurate depiction of our current judicial system, what we have described there in Isaiah 10, 1 and 2. That is our current judicial system, justice, criminal justice system. As I've said before, emphasis on criminal, not justice. That is disposed, or at least functions, for the most part, so as to wrest judgment or justice from the poor in society, as a whole anyway. Or at least the balance, if you think about it, is tipped in favor of the rich, who under this current system can afford better and more lawyers than can the poor. You think the poor has a fair shot in our today's government? Not at all. Or today's courts, I should say. Which is itself, if you think about it, a form of unjust weights and measures. And is therefore theft in and of itself. But don't be mistaken. Individual judges are sometimes prejudiced or partial to the poor. The fact is that unless governed solely by the commandments, statutes, and judgments of Yahweh's laws, today's quote-unquote conservative judges, and you'll see why I say conservative here in a little bit, quote-unquote conservative, but today's conservative judges, as they are looked upon, are probably politically inclined to favor the rich. And today's liberal judges, the poor. And therefore, the Bible prohibits partiality or bias toward the poor or the rich. It doesn't favor one over the other, because all you have to do is go back up to verse 3 and you'll see just the opposite of what we just read in verse 6. It says, "Neither shall thou countenance a poor man in his cause." NASV puts it a little bit clearer. It says, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute, neither poor nor rich. In fact, Leviticus 19:5 combines the two. It says, "You shall do unto unrighteousness in judgment. Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, or the rich, but in righteousness shall thou judge thy neighbor, whether rich or poor." James 2:9 essentially sums it up. James said this. He said, "But if ye have respect to persons, if you're biased, if you're prejudicial to persons, ye commit sin." Period. And are convinced or convicted by the law as a transgressor. By what law? Right there in Exodus 23, 3 and 6, and Leviticus 19 and verse 15. Look at also in Exodus, since we're there, Exodus 23, 8, this pertains as well. It says, "And thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise and perverteth the words of the righteous." Now that could be regards to a judge, or of course it could be in regards to somebody who's been a witness to a crime as well. Deuteronomy 1. In fact, turn to Deuteronomy, if you will. Take this a little bit further. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verses 16 and 17, and we'll jump down to chapter 16. Deuteronomy 1:16, he says, "And I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is with him." Now, there's a little bit more here I want you to catch than just the fact that they were to be impartial in judgment and they were not to be bribed. Verse 17, it says, "You shall not respect persons in judgment, but you shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid of the face of man, for the judgment is God's. And the cause that is too hard for you, bring unto me and I will hear it." Now jump over to chapter 16. Deuteronomy 16 and verse 18. And there we find it says, "And judges and officers shall thou make thee in all thy gates." Now the gates were the place of business. They came to the gates of the city. It was the place of business, and it's often where the courts were held. "Judges and officers shall thou make thee in all thy gates, which Yahweh thy God giveth thee throughout thy tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment." Now we're going to continue into verse 19 here just before we conclude this, because that's where I want to eventually get to. But I want you to note here in those two passages in Deuteronomy, to begin with, don't miss, note that there is no provision there in those two passages or anywhere in God's law or in the Bible as a whole, for that matter, for juries. There's a lot of our people who are hep on juries, especially if we could bring jury nullification back in. Well, it'd be a whole lot better if we had jury nullification, you bet. But note, that's man's idea. Juries are man's idea. And as good as it may be with jury nullification put back into it, it's still imperfection because it's not God's idea. Juries are unnecessary when you do it biblically. When only biblically qualified judges are appointed, not elected, are appointed. A lot of people want to start electing the judges, not God's way. Are appointed as prescribed in Yahweh's law. Yeah, but what if we end up with a liberal judge? You weren't listening to me. I said biblically qualified judges. Under Yahweh's system, there would be no such critter as a conservative or a liberal judge. Either one. But simply judges who carry out justice as prescribed in Yahweh's law. Period. There's no interpretation. It's this is the law. This is what's carried out. It wouldn't take a lot of deliberation. The guy's found guilty. Here's the application. Go out and stone him. Take retribution from him. Times two, times five, times four, or whatever was required. Our attention, our vision, in many different ways, but on this one as well, has been diverted to the wrong issue. Everyone today is always talking, when it comes to judges, is always talking about the conservatives versus the liberal judges sitting on both the lower courts and especially on the Supreme Court. But the issue, brethren, is not conservative or literal, but simply justice, period. And the fact is, when compared with biblical justice and equity, which is the only justice and equity that can be found on the face of this earth. And when compared with biblical justice and equity, we no longer have any conservative justices left whatsoever. Except in that some justices today are conservative liberals. But they're all liberals. I assure you, they are both liberal and left when compared to Yahweh's laws and the judges that His Word demands in the Bible. And in that light, there are very few, if any, judges today who could even get on the bench as per the biblical qualifications, which is essentially the same problem we have with juries today. They are seldom, if ever, governed any longer by justice, biblical justice, that is. But instead, they are governed by the morality or immorality, as the case may be, of the general population at any given time. Listen to me, don't forget, it was a jury that found O.J. Simpson innocent of all charges. And it was a jury who awarded millions of dollars to a woman who spilled hot coffee on her lap. And it happens all the time. Don't tell me juries are the answers, even with jury nullification. It wasn't God's answer. Yahweh's more perfect way, the only perfect way, is that only biblically qualified men be appointed and continue in that capacity so long as they remain qualified. And if not, they're to be removed by the people. So, what are those qualifications? I'm sure you're wanting to know. Well, to be appointed a judge or a leader or a ruler under God's system, a man had to possess all of the following credentials, among others. Among other things, he must be, under the new covenant, a Christian, a fellow Israelite, one who fears Yahweh, one who does not fear man, one who is schooled in the laws of Yahweh, not the laws of the Pharisees as they are today, one who has written out his own copy of Yahweh's laws, one who daily reads Yahweh's law, one who scrupulously observes the laws of Yahweh in his own life, a man of truth, one who is just, one who is impartial in judgment, one who is unable to be bribed, one who is neither greedy nor covetous, one who is a terror to the wicked, and a champion of the righteous. Man, just to have that last one fulfilled today. A man who is a champion for the righteous and a terror to the wicked, let alone all the others. And then, even if a man meets all of those qualifications, the qualifications he must be to be appointed, he still may not be a viable appointee, because it is possible for his wife or his children to disqualify him. He must also manage his own household well. In other words, he must be the head of his own house. How many men are going to qualify there? We're going to rule out probably 75% of them right off the bat with just that one thing alone. With a dignified, non-gossiping, sober, faithful wife and faithful, non-rebellious children. And so he can meet all the other qualifications, but if he's not the head of his home, not leading his own family as God intends him to, he's out. He's not to be appointed. All of that gleaned from Exodus 18, 19 through 21, if you want to check these out. Deuteronomy 1, 13 through 17, 17, 15 through 19, 2 Chronicles 19, 5 through 8, Romans 13, 1 through 4, 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 13, and Titus 1, 5 through 9. Bob, would you repeat that for anyone who didn't get it? What I just described, these are the types of men, and yes, I did say men, and I meant to say men, whom Yahweh directed as us to appoint as leaders, not elect. You elect, you get just the lesser of two evils. I don't want evil, even if it's the lesser of two evils. I want God's best. His way is perfect. These are the cut of men described by the Apostle Paul, by the way, in Romans chapter 13, as ministers of God to thee for good. That's the kind of men he was talking, that we are to whom we are to obey and honor. And why not? When it's those type of men. Someone who is a minister of God to thee for good. But it's hardly a term that fits most politicians and bureaucrats today. We need to understand in all of this that anything short of Yahweh's righteous standard is spiritually and politically, you can't separate the two anyway, is spiritually and politically left, liberal, and ungodly. There isn't any right, and they're politically or spiritually today in today's government, because it all falls short of his righteous standard. It is all left, it is all liberal, and it's all ungodly. Regrettably. Very quickly, and back to Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18 with verse 19. Judges and officers shall thou make thee in all thy gates, which Yahweh thy God giveth thee throughout thy tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. Thou shalt not wrest judgment, thou shalt not respect persons, neither take a gift or a bribe, for a gift or a bribe does blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. The phrase, thou shalt not respect persons, in the Hebrew, literally means thou shalt not recognize faces. There was to be no partiality whatsoever. R.J. Rushdoony in the Institutes in Biblical Law, page 535, said this: the judge thus must be blind to the persons in the case and must see the issues involved. The bribe exactly reverses this. The judge is then blind to the issues and sees only the persons. End of that quote. The latter, I assure you, with the latter, I should say, the law will be perverted, and the courts will be used, and are today, for plunder and theft, much the same as much of the rest of our government does and is. May Yahweh help us to see our way, to seek only God. Let it be that we would see through, to seek only His perfect law, as per the eighth commandment and all of the other commandments and their statutes and judgments as well. And with them, His kingdom here on earth as it already is in heaven. Amen. All right, let's go to our Father and close this one in prayer. Heavenly Father, we ask in prayer that You would bless this message and this whole series, that it would again be a part of awakening our people, if not now, then sometime down the road. You've allowed us to be able to retain these messages in Your word and Your law, not only in written form, but through messages that are reserved and kept for us on tape and CDs now, that for many generations might be used. Let these reach the people to whom, Father, can make a difference. Reach the Christians of this nation and help them to see how perfect Your kingdom and Your laws really are. And let us someday replace this imperfect, ungodly system that we are under now. We ask Your, Father, Your mercy and your judgment, and yet Your mercy and judgment as well, that we might be brought back to You as you intend. Let it be so. Let it be through Yeshua the Christ and His blood atoning sacrifice. And it's in Him that we pray. Amen.